Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have as our guest today, Jason Wilson from Houston. Jason is involved in a new venture called Bearings Legal Resources that we're going to talk about today. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
We're going to talk about a lot more than just that, though. We were chatting before we hit record and decided we needed to hurry up and start recording because you were getting into some of the good stuff. So tell us about your background and what led you to become a lawyer.
I was a philosophy major at the University of Houston. I graduated with about 8 people. I know that people that I've seen on social media have visceral reactions to things like Big Bang Theory. But if you can imagine a group of individuals sitting at the cafeteria nerding out about Wittgenstein or Plato or anything else, it was sort of this group. But I always knew that I didn't have the philosophical chops to go on to a high-quality master's program, and certainly I had no desire to get a PhD, which was sort of, I felt like, the only trajectory for somebody with a philosophy degree. And at some point along the way, when it came time to do my senior honors thesis, I ended up in sort of critical legal studies. And there was a professor at the University of Houston Law School at the time, James Hergett, that I partnered up with as an advisor to help with my honors thesis. And he became part of my panel. I had to defend it. And he was a sort of a really interesting sort of process and background. And I really enjoyed the whole aspect of having to write, you know, 100+ thesis on something that I'm mortified, just absolutely mortified going back and reading, because my writing skills and everything else have evolved so much over time, now at 51. But I also just truly didn't understand the full scope of the history of the movement and then its impact and then sort of my overall thesis in general. But from that, I grew to really appreciate sort of like law and theory and wanting to get into practicing law. But I wasn't exactly sure whether I wanted to commit myself fully to law. So I enrolled at the time. SMU was offering a joint JD program with the Cox School of Business. And so I did a joint MBA program up there. But then I was dating a woman and one thing leads to another, getting married, and she's in Houston and, you know, going to nursing school. So I found my way back to Houston and transferred to South Texas because I decided, I'm going to be a litigator. And I was at SMU and we had a great deal of success in our moot court program at the time, had fantastic opportunities there. Yeah, it's just sort of one thing leads into another. And eventually I ended up interning at the First Court of Appeals with Judge O'Connor while I was in law school, just as a byproduct of being in the same building. You know, you don't really get to pick your judges. And I ended up with her. And the next thing you know, I'm briefing attorney and then with O'Connor's publishing.
So. There's a lot more to talk about there. Yeah. You're a native Houstonian, if I remember.
I am. I grew up in Oregon for a period of time in Corvallis. My dad was an organic chemistry professor at Oregon State University. And did the PhD program when he was up there. And I was very disappointed when we moved back to Houston because Oregon, where we were living, is this beautiful country. Then we moved to this flat, desolate area near the swamplands. So, but yes, I am native Texan and native Houstonian. So,
as someone who grew up in the swamplands, I can certainly sympathize with that.
I mean, was it really that the court was in the same building at South Texas at the time. And I do remember that because that would have been back in the 90s, I suppose.
Early 90s, yes. Yeah. South Texas had, at the time, a restriction on the number of hours you could work outside of law school. I think it was like 20 hours. Internships didn't count towards that because they were credit hours. I was also clerking at a mid-sized firm called Lawrence and Thompson at the time. And Larry Thompson was the lead partner because Tom Lawrence was sort of like, I guess, kind of counsel. He was getting older and sort of retiring out. Larry's brother, by the way, was Tommy Thompson, who wrote Of Blood and Money.
And classic Houston book.
Classic Houston book. Yeah, I remember asking him at one point, did he have any of Tommy's old files? Because, you know, Tommy died. And Tommy was an old post writer, too, for those of you on the podcast that remember the greatest paper that we had in the city of Houston, which was the Houston Post. And Tommy was a writer for the Houston Post for a long time. But I think he died sometime after his last book. I think he'd been studying as a croupier for Vegas. But Larry still had all of Tommy's old files for Blood and Money. And It was fun to sort of go back through those and listen to tape recordings of the interviews that were done and the lawyers involved and everything else. It's just sort of like a step back in time because I read the book as a kid. So John Hilmer, Dr. Hilmer's was fascinating. So
any of our Houston listeners who haven't read that book, go check it out. It is worth your time. And it's an interesting tale of Houston lore.
Also billed as one of the first authors to sort of create the genre of novelized nonfiction, where if you've ever read Den of Thieves by James Stewart, kind of a thing where this is a true story, but I'm presenting it to you almost as if it reads as a novel, something that really hadn't existed up to that point. So I had been clerking with them on the side for basically since I got back to Houston. My 2L year was really sort of attached to a really big case that they had that was resulted in, as I've mentioned to you guys on Twitter spaces before, Freeman versus Granada or Bianchi versus, I can't remember that the Supreme Court case eludes me right now, but inadvertent waiver of attorney-client privilege, largely because it resulted out of boxes and boxes of documents that were produced in Detroit or Philadelphia, where the lawyers are going through them. And they're like, you sure this is everything you want to produce? And they're like, yeah, whatever's there is yours.
Wow.
That was kind of a very interesting time to sort of be on the cusp of looking at evidentiary law and privilege. And it was also sort of on that cusp of Rambo litigation, I guess, is what we called it back then, right?
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, Litigation Analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with Litigation Analytics on Westlaw Edge.
Well, you got connected to Judge Michael O'Connor, as you mentioned. I think you said you had you actually interned in her chambers. Did you work as her briefing attorney as well?
Yeah, for a brief time until I quit to basically commit full time to the publishing venture. Fortunately, her previous briefing attorney was like, all right, now I'll keep doing this. So I'd gotten enough of a taste of doing appellate stuff while I was there. But I also knew that, how many Anders briefs do you want to see as part of all this? How many records do you really want to read in a week? How many pre-sub memos do you want to do? You're just sort of moving things through the system, which is really great. Just wasn't what I wanted to do.
Well, and let's take a little step back for those folks who don't know all about the story of Judge O'Connor and how the publishing venture got started. Tell us a little bit about how that got going and where it wound up and what your role was in that.
So in the 80s, she was an appellate practitioner. I think she worked with O'Quinn and Abraham Watkins. I think she was actually with Abraham Watkins at the time. She had written a CLE paper that was pretty thick, but it was a practice manual on civil procedure essentially. And people had sort of encouraged her to write a book about it. And there was this guy, I'll be honest with you, I can't remember exactly how she got attached to Texas Lawyer, but at the time, Texas Lawyer was starting up a publishing venture. And she ended up with them, and they published her first book. And a guy that started it, Stephen Brill, went on to start Court TV as well. At some point, there was a disagreement over copyright and updating, and she sued for her copyright, got that back, won the money in the settlement, and the money went to sort of starting her own publishing company with both the Texas Appeals book, which had been published by Texas Lawyer as well, and the Civil Trials book. Well, I joined, it started doing work probably right after they did it was sort of like a supplement, a pamphlet supplement to the Texas Appeals book. The first product I actually worked on was, I think, Texas Forms, when we started doing civil trials forms. I was the first lawyer. I was essentially, at the time, they were like, we don't need a lawyer. Like, you know, we're fine. You can do all of this. And it's like, no, we need a lawyer. Fast forward later, hundreds of employees and so forth over the years. And I think we ended with, I guess we had about 25, 30 lawyers.
And to also give some flavor for our non-Texas listeners, Connors really did become a publishing empire as far as legal resource books. Anybody who practices here, I will say that not everyone is a fan.
No, they shouldn't. And they shouldn't be.
And I happen to be a user of O'Connor's books to this day, and do think that they're extremely valuable as a starting point for research. But it's really incredible the depth and breadth achieved in that publishing venture out of something that started with an article published in Texas Lawyer, it sounds like.
Well, actually, it was 323 pages of a CLE paper that she was doing with the Texas Bar.
So, Texas Lawyer, I should say, as far as
Texas Lawyer published the book. That was one of their first publications. She did things differently with annotations on the rules and things like that. And it obviously resonated with people. Before I actually worked for them, I owned a copy of that book and had it heavily annotated myself because it was extremely valuable as a clerk. To be fair, at SMU, Bill Dersanio was also one of our mentors, my moot court partner, and had a number of meetings with Bill, and just a brilliant mind as well. Totally different writing style, but having the pleasure of sort of seeing both of them in action and thinking through problems and everything else just really was sort of a unique experience for me.
That's one of my earliest memories of seeing an actual like rules annotation book was the Dersanio's, I want to say it was the rules. Can't remember how many different volumes were put out under his name. You know, in law school, they weren't directing you to the annotated volumes of statutes. You were looking at the statutes or the case law primarily. And I remember my judges, when I was clerking, my judge's staff attorney bringing this kind of cool book that was about yay thick into me and showing me, you know, see, here's the statute. See these annotations? Go look at these. I'm like, what is this book? And it turns out it was Dersanio's. I was enthralled right away with this reference book that had never been presented to me before. I'm glad you brought up Dersanio's because I suppose Connors and Dersanio's wound up in sort of head-to-head competition later on.
Bill had, for a while, had done a blue book. Matthew Bender had done a blue book, which was a compilation of like Texas rules and civil CPRC, I think, annotated. It was really thick, but they discontinued it. I think after 2004, 2003, they didn't publish it for very long. It felt more of a concordance of cases in some regards rather than sort of a curated list. And I don't know how much Bill, Professor Dersanio had in terms of involvement with that product. Mm-hmm. It's so hard to know within sort of large editorial organizations, but I had the highest regard back in the day when editors from different publishing companies actually spoke to one another. I had the highest regard for the folks at Matthew Bender who were in San Francisco at the time. They're just top-notch products that they were producing. Life is very different now in terms of writing and producing content, but back in the 90s, it was lovely.
What kind of stuff did you do when you were getting started there? I mean, what was your job as a lawyer at a legal publishing company?
This is a great story. You leave a life of excitement, and I put that in air quotes, in terms of just sort of like dealing with clients. I mean, look, being an associate or anything else is fun. It's exciting. There's aspects to it that, yes, there's, depending on the firm, there's all sorts of things that you have to deal with. But in publishing, the first job that I had was creating all of the history notes to the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. That was going back to the 1941 issue of the Bar Journal, going forward for every single rule, and sort of annotating in terms of history notes, knowing what changed from year to year in every single rule for the rules of procedure, evidence, and appellate procedure.
Wow.
You want to talk about tedium and you want to talk about nerding out on changes in terms of changes of language and meaning and everything else. That's what I did. I would never do it again, but I learned the importance, and particularly as far as I think appellate practitioners were concerned, I need to know if the language of this particular rule was the same, like what was going on in 1962 when this changed. If you don't have a good resource that directs you immediately to where you can find the Supreme Court order and take a look at the differencing, that's tough.
That's exactly right.
I can't believe that no one had done it before.
No one had done it before. There's only two products on the market that have history rules to the rules. O'Connor's and ours, which we did differently, but it's hugely, hugely important.
It's one of those things that you don't think about until it really matters.
Well, that obviously was a major undertaking. How did your role at O'Connor's evolve over time? And taking a step back from that, you talked about your educational background. And aside from your connection with Justice O'Connor, what made you think that going into legal publishing was going to be a good fit for you?
Widgets, just making things. Obviously, I knew I was missing out on practice, so I left for a while to go back into the practice. And it was about 2.5-3 years. Had a nice break, went into, I had an interesting docket of federal and state trial work, civil appeals. I actually dabble. I had a warehouseman client that was involved in state securities board work. And so you do some administrative stuff and you do contracts, and I needed to get that out of my system and know for sure that I didn't want to milk the cow, so to speak, and wanted to get back to doing something else. And the guy that I hired to replace me, or, you know, that we agreed on, didn't really work out as far as leading up the editorial group at the time. So I ended up going back, took a pay cut to go back. It's just one of those things where, you know, you have a calling in life and there are just certain sacrifices that you make to do it. And my wife was like, fine, do it. And we executed on it. And I really felt like, oh, I'm going to go back and I'll recapture all this time that I'm spending on Saturdays and Sundays at the firm. No, turns out it's what we like to call startup culture now is just making a business. So you actually spend more time doing it than you would otherwise.
I imagine there's something that's kind of satisfying, though, about treading a path that no one has ever really tread before. I mean, O'Connor's and kind of what you guys were developing didn't really exist until you made them.
I think the biggest impact was when we released Causes of Action. Obviously, we all grew up, look, I grew up researching out of West Digests. No one was allowed to touch the Westlaw terminal. It's like dot matrix printer, and it's $2,000 to look up a case.
You didn't have the CDs?
No, we did. So the greatest thing that ever came along were the damn premise CDs from Thomson Reuters or from West Publishing at the time. And so we had one of those CD carousels. And it's like, are you telling me I can research cases all day long and it doesn't matter? Yes, this is fantastic. And then when we got Butterworth, the CCR, the court's charge reporter on CD-ROM as well, it was like, oh my gosh, I can look up jury charges from Texas and see language for causes of action that aren't laid out in, forgive me if anybody on this podcast has never used this source before, but texture. I think they were up to texture second by the time I was practicing. But I mean, the CDs, it changed our lives, I think, in many ways. For us, we're still looking up things by the key number system. And I know it's greatly maligned by many people, but back in the day, it's hard to imagine how we would have muddled through finding case law.
Greatly maligned. I'm not sure I ever really understood that. It seems like where people get into trouble with the key numbering system is when all they do is copy the text out of the headnote and they don't bother to read the case. But right. In any event, the CDs, I was exposed to that back around that same time and thought it was the greatest thing ever. And of course, you know, I'm able to use a lot of those same research strategies today online through Westlaw that I was able to use in the 90s searching up the CDs. But right. In some of our previous conversations, and mostly I think on Twitter spaces, you have learned a lot over the course of the last 25 years or so. I would say even though you're not a practicing lawyer and haven't practiced that much in your career, you know, just being exposed to the content of your books, primarily going back to the O'Connor's books, and of course, going forward too. I mean, it's really surprising. I've been impressed with how knowledgeable you are about things like statutory interpretation and things that really matter to lawyers. And of course, these are things that appear as in the reference books because they're so critical to what lawyers do on a daily basis. Is there anything else that you feel like you've developed a secondary expertise in? Maybe besides, I'll throw a statutory interpretation out there.
Gosh, drinking from the fire hose.
Learning how to learn. I mean,
that's learning how to learn. Judge O'Connor's, one of her greatest quotes was, "I write so I can forget." So you talk about the things that I've learned, I've forgotten most of them. That's largely because they're on paper. And so I can just go back and look. And particularly in context of just sort of thinking about Professor Walensky's comments on legal writing and teaching students. And I was fortunate at SMU. I had a, I think you mentioned sort of like adjunct teaching. What would I even teach? I had an adjunct professor for legal writing at SMU, Doug Loftus, who was with Gardier Wen and Sewell at the time. And I'm pretty sure he had all of us doing memos for him on actual cases just to see what would happen. Having sort of that practical approach to things was hugely important. What I've learned, I think, in terms of writing and issue digestion is really outlining and trying to dive into material and trying to organize canon in some way. Whether we're dealing with statutory or common law, trying to find some sort of organizational structure that makes sense and that explains things. What I miss, and Yvonne Ho, who's with Bracewell and one of our editorial board members, the application of cases, like where a client comes in and you're having to go into a different circuit or you're faced with a fact problem and you're having to apply U.S. Supreme Court law or decisional authority from other circuits that sort of, you know, works the edges of, say, personal jurisdiction or anything else. And when you are writing about the law, it's very different than writing about a case utilizing the law and then trying to find ways to extend it around the edges of that case. And that's what I miss a lot because you don't get that in terms of creating content. But I do know that there aren't a lot of lawyers that are looking at writing pleading standards for Texas. The one thing I've learned is whether I'm writing for O'Connor's or whether I'm writing for our current company, it's you're just not going to find people that are willing to spend a lot of time on esoteric issues that aren't going to get likes or blog hits or they're not good for bar journal articles or CLE papers or whatever else. And so the wheel is going to have to be rewritten over and over by countless lawyers that may be confronted with that situation. That's what I've learned. And how to spot dicta.
Which is an important skill, because it turns out that the test that I see for dicta is something bad that I don't really want to apply in my case, even though it's binding authority.
Yep.
Which is not the actual test for dicta.
To be fair, we had a very robust law student program before our company was sold. So having all the students in, and we used to have a author lecture series where our authors would come in and talk about the practice of law and things like that. But you also sort of get a really good sense of, it's almost like a mini law review, but with people that graduated law school or were in their third year or whatever, or their second year. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like, but you're being tested on sort of real world application. Like the work you're doing is actually going into a paid product. So you better have a good sense of reading these cases.
This is not a hypothetical situation. You're not writing a memo for a partner in an office. This is real world stuff that people are paying good money for,
right,
and need to be able to rely on. So definitely important work. You mentioned a couple of times the sale, and I want to get into what you're doing now. But if you would, just briefly cover kind of what the outcome was with O'Connor's and that transition, and how you got into, I guess, couldn't help yourself and got into yet another startup situation.
So the company was owned by Judge O'Connor and her son in the end of 2017. I think January 4th, they consummated the sale to Thomson Reuters of O'Connor's. Gosh, some point in 2018, it may have been that same year. Forgive me, I'm never certain on dates any longer. But they, as a part of an overall corporate restructuring, they shut down the New York editorial offices where we had, oh gosh, I think 300 people. It was like their oldest office, their oldest editorial group in New York, in Rochester. They shut down that office. They shut down our office. They shut down the Rutter office in California, I think in Ventura. Then people were offered a chance to work from home or basically take severance. Or you could relocate to Minnesota if you wanted to do that. A very prescient decision, right? Pre-COVID. When you think about it, it's hard to knock the decision, largely because you've got 200 and something properties across the globe and you're looking to reduce footprint. And if you feel like you can be more successful at a work from home strategy, then sure. Particularly when it comes to editorial or even production type work. I knew that I wasn't somebody that was going to stay with a 25,000 employee company. I'm not a corporate person. I don't fit well in corporate structure. So I took a package and left.
You still had the publishing bug, so to speak.
Well, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I knew that I had plenty of runway to figure it out. It's one of those things where events come together and you've got some other folks that left and they're doing things, and you just sort of like, at some point you're just like, hey, yeah, like, you know, I like writing, you know, I like, you know, explaining things. I'm an educator. It's absolutely insane when you think about it, because we wrote a California civil procedure manual, because why not? Well, we've got O'Connor's in Texas. Surely we can write a brilliant California civil procedure manual. It just turns out that everybody loves Rutter's. Back in the early 2000s, I had met Bill Rutter and his executive editor out in California. I got to meet Pete Rose when I was at lunch with Bill Rutter. So I felt like I've made it. But it turns out that competing with really entrenched brands is hard to do. And it's just hard to get away from not wanting to rewrite things and explain things in different ways and really connect with lawyers in the community, which is something that I greatly missed, because I can assure you that I've met more lawyers across more practice areas as a publisher than I probably would have ever have met as a practitioner. That's been hugely rewarding.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com. So this is the new venture is, as we said, Barings Legal Resources. And I took a look at the website and I see that, you all have some products headed to market. Yes. Some others coming soon. It's a fair description. I'm telling you if it's not, Jason.
No.
You're putting out product that is essentially, you know, annotated code books, Texas
the first. Rules.
The Civil Price and Remedies Code is one of the inaugural products.
Correct.
You're starting from scratch, you know, blank sheet of paper in front of you. We all know that feeling. What is that like? Tell us about the process you go through in creating an annotated code book from scratch. That's got to be pretty daunting.
So annotated codes are interesting. I want to back up real quick. The Civil Litigation Guide is a guide, 900 pages of commentary so far. Mm-hmm. So it's a thick book in addition to just the rules annotated as well. That was actually going to be our flagship product. We just got waylaid at the end of the year last year with a couple of issues. And we decided, you know, we need to pivot and make sure we get the CPRC out in time because it's a companion product to the book. When you approach annotating codes, in terms of what we're looking at, we want to provide a curated list of content that if you flip to a code section, you could actually start research with. It's not like NODs where, you know, if you're online, which are great, but if you're online and you're looking at a TOC and you drill down on a key number link and you've got a bunch of headnotes that you're having to scroll through, it's not necessarily focusing you in the right direction. What our goal is to really draw down on the seminal cases for that. One of the things that we always felt was a drawback in product that we used, even our own, was the lack of headings to really organize everything under statutes. It's the same thing with all historical research, and particularly for people that do venue or limitations, and you know that some of these statutes have been around since the 20s and haven't changed at all. You need to know what a transient person status is. I don't know. I mean, it's just the weird little issues that come up and then common issues that come up all the time. But finding a way to organize things and present them in a compact form is super important, but also having access to content that's verified. So I can't express enough to people that use services to be sure that what you're reading is actually the most current version, updated version of a statute or a rule. Even for lawyers that go to the Texas Supreme Court website and download the January 2021 version of the rules, there are errors in those rules. And there just are. So some of them are formatting errors, right? Maybe some language duplication errors, but you have to be first and foremost, what you produce, the law has to be right, but your annotations have to bring some clarity around that.
I didn't mean to short the library of publications in terms of what you have and suggest that it was only annotated codes.
No, it's quite all right.
I'm glad that you clarified that you're publishing a civil litigation guide. And I think that's really what I had in mind as far as, you know, trying to imagine the volume of work that goes in to drafting that something like that, you know, soup to nuts has to be tremendous. So I know you've got a board of editors. Are the editors also, you know, creating the bulk of the work product, the content?
No. So what I learned right at the beginning was really busy lawyers have no time to write substantive content, but they're really good at reading and knowing whether or not something you said isn't accurate. Now, what's really funny in family law, when we wrote the family law handbook, there were a number of instances where like, yes, we know what the code says, but nobody really does that. And so there's that, right, that gap between the law and practice. we're really good at cataloging everything and writing everything. What you have to acknowledge is your weakness in some practical applications of rules, right? As we all know, anybody that's done appellate law, there's only so much that goes up through appellate courts. And that's a function of passion and money. If you don't have either one of those, then a lot of things are going to be left at the trial court level. I learn this all the time, which is why it's great to have friends who are trial court lawyers and who are in arbitrations and mediations and have to grind it out every single day doing stuff. They do have practical applications of rules and they get stymied by some of the things and they have to just look at the language of the rule because there is no case that's going to help them. So a lot of legal writing, and it's one of the things that I sort of admired about Bill Dersanio, which was he knew a lot of people. He was in the trenches. He understood grinding out some problems, and you could really bring some attention and focus around issues that would never be revealed in appellate law. For us, we know that there's a danger in terms of advocating for things, and we don't want to really take sides on either side of the docket, right? You know, you kind of want to leave things open-ended. Unless the Supreme Court has really closed the door on something.
You're making me think about the few times in my career when opposing counsel actually cited O'Connor's. I never quite knew what to make of that.
It's funny because O'Connor's was written, all books were written to never be cited. The whole issue was, look, here's a statement of law. Here's a case, a rule, statute, several cases, whatever. You go look at those and determine whether or not those are applicable, right? Mm-hmm. Is this a correct statement? I won't name names, but there's a local judge who told me fairly recently, if a lawyer came in and quoted O'Connor's, I knew exactly what type of lawyer that was. A lazy lawyer. It's hard to disagree with that. Because the whole point to the products wasn't to quote it. It was to give you information so that you could be smarter. You could be right. More knowledgeable, that you could start out and you could research from there. Don't quote it.
Right. It's an efficiency tool.
Right. Your job is to figure out what the law is. And I'm not saying that we're not, exactly, just as Jody said, it's an efficiency tool. It's to cut down on the time that it takes to get from point A to point B.
And they're very valuable for that. That's what I use them for. If I don't happen to know the law off the top of my head, that's where I will start. It will get me started on something and either refresh my memory or head me down the right path.
Right.
So they're super useful for that. I certainly expect
that. Oh, definitely.
That Bearings products are going to accomplish that same thing. So you've got the CPRC is on its way out. Litigation guide is on its way out.
The end of the year, yeah. Discovery, trial, post-trial, more annotated codes. Obviously, we'll be tackling business and commerce code, business organizations code. The luxury of this imprint is that we can work with other authors in a way that we couldn't with O'Connor's and produce additional content. So one area that I've been wanting to get in is ethics and really not just disciplinary stuff, but lawyer advertising. It seems like we've been dabbling in DR rules for the last 3 years. And so really just sort of coming out with a comprehensive guide to all of that written by people that obviously are involved in either sitting on regional panels or have been involved in crafting DR rules or were at the top of all of that. So, you know, just we've had a number of folks interested in producing content, but it's not easy to do. And you're looking at the long game on anything. If you want to make good content, it's never going to come easy. But I also am a firm believer in several things. Number one, customer service and dealing with lawyers and listening to them. Number two, pricing. Legal information doesn't come cheap for, and when you've got basically two large publishers controlling most of secondary content, it's not going to, there's at no time will it, the pricing go down, and it will often outpace inflation, and it will not necessarily be up to standards that you might want. Now, that's up to every lawyer to decide for his or her own. But we also still believe in print. We believe in digital. So we're delivering digital solutions that are devoid of having a subscription. Mm-hmm. So you can just put those on anything you want and carry it around. And that cuts down on the time to deliver print. So it's print fidelity, and you have it and it's yours.
Still just something about opening the book and flipping through those.
Well, and it's nice to have good paper, and it's nice to have readable fonts. You know, I mean, obviously, I'm a big fan of Matthew Butterick and, you know, all the work that we did with Typography for Lawyers, and just really happy that to have him featured in our products. And even though Equity is a little bit of a heavier font as far as printing is concerned, so we hope that, you know, there won't be too much bleed through on pages, but I think we'll be fine.
I look forward to seeing that. The litigation guide, does it cover appellate too, or do you plan to have a separate volume?
Separate volumes for all of that. I'm pretty sure the only appellate stuff we should cover is mandamus and interlocutory appeals. I feel like if we just stop there, we'll be fine, since it seems like every mm-hmm. legislative session, the legislature introduces a new interlocutory appeal route for us. So mm-hmm. I'm almost positive we could just do a book on interlocutory appeals, and that would cover most of what goes up. I don't know what you guys see in your practice as far as interlocutory appeals are concerned.
You know, with the DCPA getting pulled back a little bit, the stuff that's left is a little bit more specific, but there's still, you're right though, there's a lot of different places where it comes up. And like you said, they keep adding to it, which creates more and more avenues. And then the permissive appeal part is kind of interesting too.
Right. Just out of curiosity, do you get a lot of sort of like restricted appeals off of default judgments?
I've done maybe
bill of review type stuff. I mean, do you get pulled into things like that?
Occasionally.
Yeah, same for me. Depends on which side of that you're working and what your practice setting is. In my former practice, when I was on my own, I would get called about that sort of thing not infrequently, because the larger firms typically...
Money's just not there.
Yeah,
money's just not there.
Folks that suffered a default judgment, more often than not, there was some other issue there. So it does come up from time to time. And bills of review, actually, yeah, I've done a few of those, and those are kind of fun. They're like another version of legal malpractice cases, you know, where you've got a case within a case.
Right.
It's definitely interesting, but the law there is so arcane and archaic mm-hmm. sometimes that I would not deign to sit down and try to write a volume on how to handle a bill of review.
So who's going to start chasing the 74353 interlocutory appeals on healthcare liability claim? Is that something... Now that you got a new avenue and you may have a chance of knocking something out, or is that area of the law so well defined now that everything is just subsumed under it?
I think it's mostly that. I think there are just far fewer healthcare liability claims than there used to be too. So to the extent that applies, I think it's to a pretty narrow subset of things that are out there. And I bet what you're going to see is mostly the people who are already doing the healthcare liability defense work that are just taking those things up on appeals, kind of their parcel of what they do normally.
Right.
Well, you mentioned Butterick, and I was going to ask you about this. I was hoping maybe you would tell this as your tip or war story that we're going to get to later, but because this is an appellate law podcast, and most everyone who's listened to this is going to know who Matthew Butterick is, the Typography for Lawyers book that he wrote, but you actually played a personal role in that book even getting written in the first place, as right. I understand it. Tell us a little bit about that.
I approached him after, I don't know if he had launched a website or he had written something about document design and brief design and things like that. I think he had launched a website at that point. And I was really sort of focused on, you know, nobody's doing this. I love typography. I love thinking about it. I really am interested about different ways of presenting documents. If anybody is familiar with with the 90s and reading briefs in the 90s and understanding what 12-point times Roman or 14-point times Roman looks like, you get a sense of just sort of how drab your practice was as far as look and feel. And Matthew seemed to have a lot of ideas around that. And so it took a while to sort of coax some of these things out, but he ultimately came up with a table of contents and really just, he just ran with it, produced a beautiful book. Other than copy editing, I don't think we did anything because he wanted full control over the product and the design and the layout and everything else. And really, the education that I got from that process and from listening to him and reading his material taught me a lot about the way we were doing certain things and approaches and cues in terms of headings and heading design. Once you get locked into a certain system, it's really hard as an organization to pivot out of that, right? But I did feel like as a product, it had something for all lawyers. Honestly, I think after seeing what's happened since then, to me, it's a huge testament to the need and the desire for that and for trying to teach lawyers about it's not just necessarily the words you write, but how you present them on the page that facilitates persuasion.
Before we wrap up with our war story or tip that we usually like to end with, where can our listeners find you? Where can they find Bearings?
Bearingslegal.com.
That's B-E-A-R-I-N-G-S, right?
B-E-A-R-I-N-G-S legal.com. Yes.
Well, and for the Appellate Twitter crew, pretty active on Twitter. You're there a lot. You participate in conversations. And so
I do.
What's your Twitter handle, Jason?
J-A-S-N-W-I-L-S-N. So without the O's.
Our kind of tradition on our podcast is to end with a tip or a war story from our listeners. And you've kind of given some great info. I don't know if you've got anything off the top of your head that you'd want to share.
So the first case I ever argued was against James Sales, an ICC motor case. And we talk about not getting too many default judgments to have to work with. Progressive Insurance was one of the companies that hired us for this appeal. And it was a $1.5 million default judgment against insured truck driver on a case. What I would say to folks is just always listen to rebuttal, because you never know what's going to happen when you're sitting at the table. And something during rebuttal may come up that for some reason in the back of your brain, you say, I know that's in the record. There's something in the record. And in this particular case, there was. It was an issue that came up during rebuttal that I heard one of the judges ask Sales a question that implicated a rider that was attached to the insurance policy. And this is back in the day where, for that case, I actually used an easel with whatever the giant Post-it flip pages and had written out a diagram of the statutes, because at that time we had a statute on the books, TRCS 911B, which interfaced with the federal ICC statute on motor carriers. And I had this whole diagram out because it was just too damn confusing in the briefs to really map everything out. I needed to have a visual, and I had no way to put the visual in a brief. And so I needed to have it next to me so I could point to it at the podium. And got done with that. I felt really good about the argument. And then I hear this one thing come up. So when I got up for my reply, I was like, I want to bring the court's attention. I got the record out. And do you guys is it digital records now? Like you probably just have digital record. So yeah, I've got the whole file, right? So I got the whole file on the podium. And for the kids out there that have never seen these, they're thick, they're big.
Oh yeah.
And I got the whole file out, the double punch holes at the top, 14 and a half inch size. And I'm going through nine, and I've got this rider marked, and I bring up the rider in my reply, and it really resonated. And then I followed it up with a letter brief to the court, and we got the case kicked on that last issue. But it really just drove home that the case is never done until the argument's completed. Like if you think you've got it wrapped up, you may not have it wrapped up. Now, maybe it's a little different now. I don't know, but that was just such a great experience because it really taught me the value to don't just sit down and not listen to opposing counsel make their argument. Because, and I know we all do. I mean, obviously, we're listening to the judges' questions and sort of gauge everything, but there may be an opportunity after you rest that, hey, look, there was something that we missed, but it's still in the record and it was still part of the briefs that you can follow up and sort of have your case twist and turn a little bit on that.
That's a testament to knowing the record.
I mean, it is.
Judge O'Connor drove that into me. She was one of the few judges on the court at the time that read the entire record and required her briefing attorneys to read the entire record.
Well, Jason, thanks for spending time with us today. Enjoyed hearing about the O'Connor's connection and history and what you're up to next. And we'll look forward to following that closely and seeing you, you know, around on Twitter. And
yeah, if you guys keep posting the Twitter Spaces conversations like you did for Professor Walensky, I think it's great. I'd love to see him in enough time to sort of hop on and sort of to listen what's going on.
Well, we appreciate that plug and we'll start putting out date and times a little earlier than we have been lately, but thanks for mentioning that. We appreciate it.
I appreciate the invite.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.